And as the standoff continued, Koresh negotiated more times, and allegedly, so he did this so he could write religious documents he said he needed to complete before he surrendered. His conversations with the negotiators included dense biblical imagery and other religious aspects. I know at one point, I think we're going to get to it here in a second, if I remember correctly. Sorry, I wrote this script a week ago, but at one point, I believe he does say that he is God, and that God is now communicating with the ATF agents.
Welcome back to the Rainy Day Horror Show. I'm Big Daddy D, and you are listening to the number one podcast on the internet. And on today's beautiful little episode, Dusty is going to be talking about, well, the second part to David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. This episode is strictly going to be about the Waco Siege. So, without further ado, I'm going to introduce your host for this evening's show, Dusty Migballs, aka the Certified Cougar Hunter, and your host with the most. Now sit back, shut up, and enjoy this episode.
Thank you, Big D, for that beautiful little intro. And yes, like he said, we are doing the Waco Siege today, part two to last week's episode. And it's going to be a good one. It's going to be kind of a lengthy one. I don't know how long it's going to be, but I will say I might kind of, well, not intentionally, but I'm getting a tattoo in about, what is it? Two and a half hours. So I might, like, not intentionally rush through this on accident. Like, what the fuck am I trying to say? I may accidentally run through this really quick, but I just want to let you guys know it is not intentional. There we go. It's midday and I'm fucking tired. And ready to go get my tattoo. I'm so fucking excited. You'll see it on my Instagram at the Rainy Day Horror Show if you follow me. It's going to be dope. I just burped if you didn't hear that. So, without further ado, we're going to jump into this episode. It's going to be a good one. It's going to be a great one. So, sit back, relax, and just let's go on a trip together. Get those Crocs on. Adventure mode, bitch. Let's do this. Now, I think, if I am correct, I don't really remember, right? Last week's episode, didn't listen to it, which I probably should have, but fucking didn't, because whatever. I think we left off with when he rose to power. When he went back to, well, when the government took back the land that Mount Carmel is on when they had it. The land bought for them because it was foreclosed upon because Gary had some unpaid taxes, right? So David Koresh ended up buying the land back and he now started his rise to power. Okay, I think we also left off with him opening up the cult to being polygamist, but only for himself. And that he has to have 140 wives before he dies. And that he was like fathering like 12 different children, or like not 12, but dozens of children. He had wives that were as young as 12 to in their 30s, stuff like that. I think that's where we left off with. Now, going into this episode and just kind of branching a little bit off of that, there were some people that went into from Child Protective Services, I think, from what I can remember, that went into this cult and kind of had to understand, like, if there is any sexual abuse, any underage marriage, stuff like that, right? If these minors are being forced to do stuff for David, right? Now, from what I found, some of these people that went, that worked with child, with CPS, that went into this cult to see if there is any abuse of minors or illegal marriages and stuff like that, they didn't find anything, but they did say that they weren't allowed to speak with the children one-on-one. Okay? So, I still think there's sexual abuse, obviously, it came out, so fuck these guys. But now we're going to jump into the Waco siege, okay? And it's going to get hot and heavy. It's going to get real hot and real heavy. So to start it off, all right? The reason they started getting weapons, all right? This is the reason. This is going to be the little prelude into the whole siege. Now, David Koresh, at the time of when they started stockpiling weapons, claimed that he had cracked the code of the seven seals in the book of Revelation, which, you know, predicted events leading to the apocalypse. Now, David told his followers that the Lord willed the Davidians to build an army of God. As a result, they started stockpiling weapons, and other branch Davidians, after all of this came out, claimed the weapons were not meant for defense, but rather were sold at gun shows to generate revenue for the sect. Now, since this was in the early 90s, the gun laws aren't as strict as they are now, well, nowadays, but I don't know if that's legal, like, if you have to have a permit to, like, sell weapons and be an arms dealer and even sell them at, like, gun shows and stuff like that. I've never been to a gun show. I've never talked to anybody who has, like, had a booth or anything at a gun show. So I don't know 100% on how that worked. I mean, it is Texas, after all. So, and we know Texas loves their guns, right? So I don't know 100%, like, if, well, I would assume Texas has some pretty lenient laws down there from the shit that I see on YouTube with their, with how many guns some of those people got, right? Like, I watch Demo Ranch. That dude has so many fucking weapons. I want them all. Like, they're so fucking sick, and I want them, but, like, God. It's just crazy. But I would assume being in the early 90s in Texas, the gun laws were pretty lax, okay? You might not have had to do a whole lot to get a permit to sell weapons. But then again, I don't know 100% about the legal side of selling weapons. Now, in 1992, the ATF became very, very concerned over reports of automatic gunfire that was coming from Mount Carmel. And this, after they heard these reports, they started an investigation. And this investigation included sending in an undercover agent to basically infiltrate the compound and see how many weapons they got and what are they doing and stuff like that. And this agent found out that there were over 150 weapons and 8,000 rounds of ammunition within this complex. Now, most of the weapons that they did have were legal semiotic weapons. However, the ATF agent that was in there alleged that there was also a number that had been illegally modified to fire fully automatic. Now, when this agent came back and reported this huge find and all this news, the ATF began surveillance from a house across the road from the compound, but their cover wasn't that great, okay? Because these agents, when they were doing this stakeout and observing the compound, they decided for some fucking reason to go undercover as college students, which didn't really work for them because, one, they were in their 30s and they weren't registered at any school. And on top of that, they did not keep a schedule which would fit any legitimate employment or classes. So, I mean, you can kind of figure that out. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that, like, oh, a middle-aged man is going to school. Like, I mean, I know some people go to school, but it's not like, you know, seeing like 4 or 5 30-year-olds going to school together. It's a little weird, right? Something's a little fishy. You don't have to be, you know, smart to even kind of pick out that something is a little weird. Now, after they started their surveillance and speculated that the Davidians had violated federal law, the ATF did obtain a search and arrest warrant for Koresh and specific followers on weapon charges due to the many firearms they had accumulated, and they planned their raid for March 1st, 1993. However, they moved it up a day in response to the Waco Tribune Herald, this like little article, and it was called Sinful Messiah. Now, this whole situation, a lot of people are very, very critical of the ATF in its initial investigation and raid. And it's strictly because of the search warrant. The warrant application and supporting affidavits contained a great deal of discussion listing large numbers of firearms and ammunition, but it had nothing to do with any violation of federal law. And you will see that throughout this episode is that our government, the ATF, the local task force in Texas, it was handled very, very poorly. Now, if it was me, well, actually, we'll get to my thoughts towards the end, but it was handled very, very poorly. Now, the initial raid happened on a Sunday morning on February 28th, in 1993, and they wanted to surprise the Davidians, but it didn't work, okay? Because as the police were going to raid this compound, a dumb fucking reporter was lost, and this stupid reporter accidentally tipped off a USPS mail carrier who happened to be Koresh's brother-in-law and asked him for directions to the Carmel compound. And he ultimately told Koresh, and they were able to prepare for this assault that was about to be pronounced on Mount Carmel. Now, after Koresh caught news of this, he then confronted the ATF agent who had infiltrated the Branch Davidians, you know, the guy that found all the weapons, and told him that they knew a raid was coming. Koresh and his followers then began arming and taking up defense positions while the women and children were told to cover, to take cover in their rooms. Now, when he told them, when Koresh told these, his followers, to go and take cover, the reason that, like, he started to explain to them that, how do I word it? He basically said something along the lines of, the agents that are coming, they're the devil, and they're here to take us away and hurt us, and God told me that we have to protect ourselves from the devil. It was something like that. I had to cut the episode really quick just to see if I could find it, and I fucking couldn't, and I remember reading it somewhere, but that's basically, it was something along the lines of that. Now, despite being informed that the Davidians knew the raid was coming, the ATF commander ordered that the raid continue. And that's exactly what happened. And I don't know why the commander ordered them to go ahead and attack, because now that they have all these weapons, and they know that they have all these weapons, they can use these weapons to fight against them. And for people that know, it's for people that know the situation, it's exactly what happened. Now, as the agents approached the site, they used cattle trailers pulled by pickup trucks that were actually owned by individual ATF agents. It is not known who fired the first shots, but it is reported that the first firing occurred at the double front entry doors. ATF agents stated that they heard shots coming from within the building, while Branch Davidian survivors claimed that the first shots came from the ATF agents outside. Now, within a minute of the raid even starting, a Davidian named Wayne Martin started to call 911, pleading for them to stop shooting. The residents asked for a ceasefire, and audio tapes clearly caught him saying, "Here they come again." And that's them shooting, not us. The local sheriff then attempted to contact the ATF force, but initially could not get through as the ATF communications officer had turned his radio off. But eventually the sheriff did get through, and he was able to negotiate a ceasefire. After the ceasefire, the Davidians, who still had ample ammunition, allowed the dead and wounded to be removed and held their fire during the ATF retreat. Steve Willis, Robert Williams, Todd McKeehan, and Conway LeBlow were the ATF agents killed during the raid, with another 16 having been injured. The Davidians that were killed in this quick little gunfight, well, it's not really that quick, but in this gunfight were Winston Blake, Peter Gent, Peter Hipsman, Perry Jones, and Jaden Wendell. Michael Schroeder was shot dead by ATF agents when he fired a Glock 19 pistol at agents as he attempted to re-enter the compound around 5 p.m. with Woodrow Kendrick and Norman Allison. The local sheriffs in audio tapes broadcast after the incident said he was not apprised of the raid. Now I'm going to give you a little bit of timeline of what happened that day. All right. 5 a.m., 76 agents assemble at Fort Hood for the drive to the staging area at the Bellmead Civic Center. According to a later Treasury Department review, the agents drove in an 80-vehicle convoy that stretched for a mile with a cattle trailer at either end. And in those cattle trailers, those were carrying ATF agents. Sorry I didn't say that later. I forgot to. But yes, they were carrying agents. Now at 9:45 a.m., ATF agents move in on the compound and the gun battle begins. Brent 948, Branch Davidian, Wayne Martin, a Waco attorney, calls 911. 11:30 a.m., ceasefire reached. 4 p.m., the first message from Koresh is relayed over KRLD radio in Dallas. 4:55, Mike Schroeder is shot dead returning to the compound. 5 o'clock, ATF spokesman Ted Royster says gunfire has continued sporadically throughout the afternoon. 7:30 p.m., David Koresh is interviewed by CNN. The FBI instructs CNN not to conduct further interviews. 8:15. ATF spokesperson Sharon Wheeler says negotiations continue with Davidians and gunfire has ended. 10 o'clock. By now, 4 children have exited the building. 10:05, Koresh talks for about 20 minutes on KRLD, describing his beliefs and saying he is the most seriously wounded of the Davidians. Okay. Now, after the ATF agents established contact with Koresh and others inside the building after they withdrew, the FBI took command soon after as a result of the deaths of federal agents. They placed an FBI special agent in command of San Antonio, Jeff Jamar, in charge of the siege. The tactical team was ran by Richard Rogers, who had previously been criticized for his actions at the Ruby Ridge incident. I'm not familiar with the Ruby Ridge incident, but maybe in the future I'm going to look up on it. Maybe next week we will look at it and see if it's good enough to be on this channel. Okay. Now we get to the really, really weird part of this episode, because for the next 51 days, communications with those inside the compound and with the FBI agents was going on. I don't know why it took 51 days. It shouldn't have taken 51 days, but it took 51 days. Bro, if it was me, you wouldn't need 51 days. You would need one person, me, and an hour with an AK, bro. I would go up in there. I would be mowing them down. I'd be giving them the business. I'd be showing them who's boss, right? I would be fucking shit up. I'd be giving them the beans. I would be like Vanilla Ice being dangled over a fucking rooftop terrace. Yes, I stole that from Eminem, okay? Suck my nuts. It's a good line, and I like it, all right? But, bro, I wouldn't... Bro, you give me an AK in like 60 minutes, I will have everything taken care of, bro. I have zero military background. But, like, bro, I got you, right? I don't know why it took 51 days. It took them so fucking long. And it was a group of 25 FBI negotiators that were communicating by telephone with the Davidians inside Mount Carmel. Which is just mind-blowing that 25 FBI agents couldn't figure this fucking shit out and get it done. I understand that there's children in there, right? I really do. But sometimes, listen, it might not be ethical, okay? It's actually not ethical at all. But sometimes you gotta sacrifice a few youngins to save a whole group of people. Matter of fact, I would have just killed everybody but the kids if I was the FBI, if I was in charge of this shit. Bro, I've tear gassed them. I would have sent the military in, Army National Guard. I would have sent the Marines. I would have sent... If SEAL Team 6 was available, bitch, they're going the fuck in there. I don't give a fuck. Murder is afoot, all right? Now, in the first few days of this negotiation phase, the FBI believed that they had made a breakthrough when they were negotiating with Koresh and an agreement that the Davidians would peacefully leave the compound in return for a message that was recorded by Koresh to be broadcasted on national radio. The broadcast was made, but Koresh then told negotiators that God had told him to remain in the building and wait. Now, despite this, soon afterwards, negotiators managed to facilitate the release of 19 children, but they couldn't come out with their parents, which is unfortunate. Now, at this point, after the 19 children were released, there were still 98 people that remained inside this compound. On day 9, the Davidians released a videotape to show the FBI that there were no hostages, but in fact, everyone was staying inside on their own free will. This video also included a special message from the one, the only, David Koresh. And as the standoff continued, Koresh negotiated more times, and allegedly, so he did this so he could write religious documents he said he needed to complete before he surrendered. His conversations with the negotiators included dense biblical imagery and other religious aspects. I know at one point, I think we're going to get to it here in a second, if I remember correctly. Sorry, I wrote this script a week ago, but at one point, I believe he does say that he is God, and that God is now communicating with the ATF agents. Did that make sense? So what he's saying is that he is God, God is him, okay? The creator of the universe, yes, the God, the biblical God, that's him, okay? And he's talking to the agents, and David is not here right now. David is somewhere else. That is basically what was said. Now, as the siege wore on, two factions started to develop within the FBI. Now, one of them was believing that negotiating with these crazy people is the answer. And the other was, we need to go in there, like me, and fuck some shit up. Which I am totally okay with, bro. Like I said, give me an AK, I'll go in there, bang bang. David Koresh, no more. Dead, gone, and buried. Now, as these two factions within the FBI started to butt heads, there was increasing aggressive techniques that were used to try to make the Davidians leave. Outside the building, 9 tanks and 5 combat engineer vehicles obtained from the U.S. Army began trolling. Not trolling, patrolling. Showing a... what is it? Showing size of force? Force? What? Fuck. Showing force. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. They're showing force. Like, hey, bro, we can keep this going. We can keep this going. We have all the necessary equipment to get you guys to come out. So you guys can come out peaceful. Or we can butt fuck you with this 30-foot barrel, right? Straight up in your ass. I have a funny joke. I had to register for a second. We could put this barrel up inside you. David, I know you probably, you know, used to taking, you know, the dildos from our Lord and Savior, right? You're probably getting fucked by God. We know it, right? You're getting God's cummy juice all over you. You're getting the cummy communists all inside your booty hole, right? How about you sit on this fucking tank and take a, I don't know what they shoot, a 10mm tank round. I don't know if that's fucking real. Okay, I don't know if that's true. It's just the first one that popped in my head. But listen, Davey, you can come out now or I can shove this barrel up your ass. Then we can see you can really dance and take the cummy communists, right? Now, as these tanks were patrolling the compound, this is funny. They also got the go-ahead from the higher-ups, the superiors in this situation, to start to destroy the buildings on the outer parts of the compound. And they also started to crush David Koresh's cars. Now, not only did they bring in these tanks to do a show of force and fuck some shit up, but another thing that they did is they started playing loud, heavily distorted music and disturbing sounds at high volumes, hoping that it would draw them out so that they couldn't sleep. They would just, you know, peacefully come out. But that didn't work either, okay? Tanks, music, not working. Eventually, what they did to the compound to hopefully get them to come out didn't work, but they cut all the power and water supply to the complex, forcing those inside to survive on rainwater and stockpiled army meals. Basically, MREs is all that they had. All that they had. Now, this situation with all these tactics that they're throwing out at them were criticized heavily later on by Schneider's attorney, Jack Zimmerman. And this is what he said. The point was this. They were trying to have sleep disturbance, and they were trying to make someone that they viewed as unstable to start with, and they were trying to drive him crazy. And then they got mad because he does something that they think is irrational. Now, despite these increasingly aggressive tactics by the FBI, I mean, I don't think they're too aggressive, but like, you know, at any point it could pop off again. But as these tactics got more and more aggressive, Koresh ordered a group of his followers to leave. 11 people left the compound and were arrested as material witnesses, which one person was charged with conspiracy to murder. Now, the children's willingness to stay with Koresh disturbed the negotiators, who were unprepared to work around the Davidians' religious seal. However, as the siege went on, the children were aware that an earlier group of children who had left with some women were immediately separated and the women were arrested. Now, during the siege, this little timeline that we're going down here of these 51 days, the siege, a number of scholars who had studied apocalypticism in religious groups attempted to persuade the Justice Department that the siege tactics being used by government agents would only create the impression within the Davidians that they were part of a biblical end of times confrontation that had cosmic significance. And this would likely increase the chances of a violent and deadly outcome, which it did, if you know the situation. If you don't know the situation, you're in for a treat. But if you do know the situation, it did lead to a really, really nasty end. Not situation, but end. Which gets us to the final assault. Now, the FBI became increasingly concerned that the Davidians were going to commit mass suicide, like how it happened in Jonestown when, you know, 900 people drank the Jesus juice or the Kool-Aid, right? That a newly appointed U.S. attorney, General Janet Reno, approved the recommendations of the FBI to mount an assault after being told that conditions were deteriorating and children were being abused inside. Because the Davidians were heavily armed, the FBI's weaponry included a 50 caliber gun and armored vehicles known as combat engineer vehicles. A plan was formed which would see the combat engineer vehicles use booms to punch holes in the walls of the buildings and then pump in CS gas, which is also tear gas, to try to flush out the Davidians without harming them. Now, the plan called for increasing amounts of gas to be pumped in over 2 days to increase pressure. No armed assault was to be made. The loudspeakers were used to tell the Davidians that there was no armed assault and to ask them not to fire on the vehicles. Despite this, you know, situation and this comment and telling them not to shoot anybody, several Davidians opened up fire. And instead of returning the fire, the FBI increased the amount of gas being used. After a little over six hours, no Davidians had left the building and instead sheltered in an underground bunker and used gas masks. The CEVs, combat engineer vehicles, were used to punch several large holes in the building to provide exits for those inside. However, several of these were blocked when the floor above collapsed, and Davidians were scared that they would be shot if they left. Around noon, three fires started almost simultaneously in different parts of the building. Even then, as the fire spread, only 9 people left the building. The remaining Davidians inside were engulfed by fire, and with footage being broadcast worldwide by television, 74 people in all ended up dying. Jeff Jamar prohibited fire crews' access to the burning building until the blaze had burned itself out, due to the danger of explosives within the fire and possible weapons fire from surviving Davidians. Nothing remains of the compound today. Only a few small chapels stand on that site, which are used by a smaller number of branch Davidians. Now let's get into the aftermath of this whole situation. What transpired after this terrible situation? It's 51-day siege, right? What the fuck happened? After this situation, various gun control groups such as Handgun Control Incorporated and the Violence Policy Center have claimed that Branch Davidians had and used 50 caliber rifles and that therefore these types of firearms should be banned. However, the U.S. Treasury Department, in a memorandum to the press dated for July 13, 1995, titled "Weapons Possessed by the Branch Davidians," provided an inventory of all the firearms and firearm-related items that were recovered from the Branch Davidians compound. The inventory shows no 50 cal rifles or machine guns, only 4 50 caliber magazines, 3 50 caliber magazine springs, and a 50 cal belt links. Several years later, the General Accounting Office, in response to a request from Henry Waxman, released a briefing paper titled "Criminal Activity Associated with 50 Caliber Semi-Automatic Rifles, which claims that the Branch Davidians did have access to and use 50 cal rifles. The GAO's claim is based off an unsourced BATF, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, claim that the Branch Davidians fired at the ATF with a 50 cal rifle. There has not been a reconciliation between the Treasury Department's account and the GAO. GAO stands for General Attorney's Office, for people that don't know. Now, actual transcripts of trial testimony and exhibit lists confirm that two 50 caliber Barrett rifles and many rounds of 50 caliber bullets, including armor-piercing bullets, were found in the remains of the compound and entered into evidence during the criminal trial in 1994 and the civil trial in 2000. Now let's talk about the fucking trial. Judge Walter J. Smith presided over the trial in which a jury found some of the surviving Branch Davidians guilty over government objections. Judge Smith impaneled, is that how you say that word? I don't know. I wrote it down. I didn't look it up. Some of these words I write down, look them up, and then figure out how to say it. I don't know how to say this one. An advisory jury in the civil case. That jury ruled in favor of the United States and against the Davidians. So, the convicted Davidians are Kevin A. Whitcliffe, convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Jaime Castillo, convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Paul Gordon Fada, convicted of conspiracy to possess machine guns and aiding Davidian leader David Koresh in possessing machine guns. Renos Lenny Avram, convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Graham Leonard Craddock, convicted of possessing a grenade and using or possessing a firearm during a crime. Brad Eugene Branch, convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Livingston Fagan, convicted of voluntary manslaughter and using a firearm during a crime. Ruth Riddle, convicted of using or carrying a weapon during a crime. Catherine Schroeder, sentenced to 3 years after pleading guilty to a reduced charge of forcibly resisting arrest. She was the only Davidian to testify against the others. Now, in the aftermath of the initial raid and stuff like that, we're going to get into a little bit of some controversies, and then I'm going to end this episode. The ATF drew heavy criticism for proceeding despite being aware that the Davidians knew of the offensive and the months-long surveillance of Mount Carmel. Some critics also continue to ask why the ATF agents turned down a direct invitation given months before the initial assault, in which Koresh spoke with the agents by phone and asked that they come talk to him about their concerns. There was also controversy over what the exact contents of the original search warrants were. Some critics claim that the ATF documentation from their observations of Mount Carmel proved that they knew that Koresh left the property every day for a run. The ATF has so far not responded to questions about why they did not wait for Koresh to leave his property on the day of the raid and then arrest him instead of staging a raid. But there you go. That's David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. That Waco thing is so fucked up. I think it is still on Netflix if you want to look it, or not look it up, but watch it. It's about the entire siege. And it's just stupid. Like, reading it, like, why didn't you just wait till he was gone to arrest him? Or why wouldn't you? The smart thing is, and I feel like a lot of people, or like a lot of cops would do this nowadays, if a place is heavily armed, and you're staging a raid to go in there, why wouldn't you just wait, right? Why wouldn't you just wait? That dumb fucking reporter fucked it all up. In all honesty, he did. Because let me back up. Like, if I know that there are some federal agents across the street and they're watching us, right? They're undercover and stuff like that. They're pretending to be quote-unquote college students. I know they're there, right? I just don't know when the raid is going to be. So you can easily get past that, right? You could think it's tomorrow. Or you could think it's next year. You don't know exactly how much information they have on you. Stuff like that, right? You don't know that at this point that there's a rat within your cult. You don't know that, right? So you got to be very, very cautious and very, very wary of what's going on. But it also keeps him on edge, always on his toes, right? So if you guys would have just, hey, raid's coming today, Koresh. They're coming for you. Do something about it. Okay, cool. Let's go get armed up. We've got all these weapons. Let's go fucking do this. We're going to fight back, right? If I was that ATF agent that called upon the assault on the assault, I would have pushed it back. I would have. And I know that there's children in this cult that are being sexually abused. I understand that. And I get it, okay? I really, really do, right? That there are people in this cult that are getting hurt. Whether that's physically, mentally, spiritually, sexually, whatever it is. I know that there's people in this cult getting hurt. Right? I'm not saying push it off for over a year or anything like that. But if you go to the assault and he was just tipped off, obviously you can't do it the next day. Can't do it the week after. Or maybe you could. But you have a little bit of time, okay? Because now he has these weapons and he knows you're fucking coming, right? Going up there guns blazing isn't going to do anything. Even though nobody really knows who shot what, right? Who shot first. It's a he said, she said kind of thing, right? So, just fucking wait. Wait. Wait like a week. Wait till it all settles down. Wait for him to wait for his guard to come down, right? And like one of the reporters said, why wouldn't you just leave? Wait and wait for him to leave, right? He goes on that run. Just wait. You can arrest anybody with the you can have a search and arrest warrant for fucking anybody, right? And especially when you, like, let's say he was on that run and that's when you decide to, like, fucking get him. Like, we got him, right? At that point, they have no communication with their leader. They don't know what's going on, right? They don't have that manipulation within the cult. Obviously, there are people that can still manipulate because it's kind of like a gang, right? Once you get rid of them, somebody else just takes their place. It's the same thing with FLDS. Because fuck FLDS, right? It's the same, like, yes, somebody would take his place briefly, but it's not the same as him being there. Because obviously, if he was there, he has all of the power, he has all of the fear. Everybody specifically looks up to him. That change of power could really fuck up the cult, right? So you arrest him while he's on that run. Try and get information out of him. You throw him in a cell, right? If all of it's correct. Now, while he's in that cell, he might get a phone call. Obviously, he's going to get a phone call. He's going to, you know, call somebody. That's just like how Warren Jeffs is doing it with FLDS. But you could still raid. It'd be way easier to raid that because now you took away the head honcho within this cult. But I don't know. Like I said, I just relay these stories to you guys and kind of like share my thoughts a little bit about it. 51 days fucking sucks. They should have. At that point, I don't know what you like. I don't know what you would want to do, bro. If it was me personally, I would have gone in there guns blazing. Like, fuck this shit. Right? It's. Because, I mean, just think of it like this, right? We've had soldiers, like, over in the Middle East, right? When it was really, really bad, like 2000 to 2012, when it was really, really bad, right? Obviously, you know, some kids pick up weapons because they think they're doing the best that's possible, right? So it would be sad to see some agents go in there and have to kill a kid, okay? I'm just saying it would be really, really sad, because nobody wants to ever kill a kid. But, like, what's the difference between this and us being in the Middle East? Other than the fact that it's a war, and we've been fighting this war, and we are going after someone or something that severely hurt the U.S. in the 2000s, right? Kind of like a not really a revenge thing, but, I mean, well, I guess in a sense it is revenge. But, I mean, we do go over them. We do help set up, you know, try to set up a government. But, like, when the Taliban comes and takes it over, then we have to go back and fix it and everything like that. I mean, obviously, I'm not trying to say that this whole Waco thing is what happened in the Middle East between the U.S. and all those countries. It's not what I'm saying. It's obviously a dumbed-down version, but there are some similarities of what is going on, of like what happened with this cult and what would happen in the Middle East. But then again, the stuff in the Middle East happened when it was in 2000, right? I know there was a few other instances where we were over there before that, but it's just, it's weird. There's kind of some similarities, and I just kind of connected the dots right now. But hope you guys enjoyed this episode. I'm going to try and edit this and get it out tonight, but if it's not out tonight, it'll be out tomorrow, so you guys will get two episodes tomorrow, because I love you. You're my favorite peoples. So, with that being said, I will catch you guys tomorrow, Serial Killer Sunday. I think we're doing Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, I think is what it is. I still haven't looked up any serial killers for you guys. I'm sorry, Washington. I love you guys. Actually, I've never been there. I would love to go there, but yeah. I'll see you guys tomorrow. So remember, stay frosty, stay foxy. Most importantly, the most important thing on this planet, stay safe, you beautiful peacocks. I love y'all. Deuces.